Welcome to another edition of Respond to Resilience, along with my co-host Bonnie Rumely, LCSW, EMTB, retired Lieutenant David Dashinger. On this episode, we'll be speaking with Michelle Giorgiani, first responder liaison at Aware Recovery Care, about substance abuse disorder in first responders, and Jason Palomara. He's the director of veteran and first responder engagement at Forge VFR, about police culture and how it relates to wellness and resilience. We invite you to like and subscribe. Our YouTube channel is Respond to Resilience. We're also on the Facebook page, Respond to Wellness, Inc. We're on bbsradio.com, Apple Podcasts, and you can find all our past episodes on respondertv.com. So we'll be back to speak with Jason and Michelle right after this.
In this family, more of us die by our own hands than by the hazards of the job. In this family, up to a quarter of 911 dispatchers have symptoms of PTSD. In this family, our mental health and wellness are in crisis while responders are quietly suffering. In this family, many struggle with job-related stress, burnout, trauma, sleep disruption, substance abuse, and marriage problems. In this family, we can help the helpers with vital information and resources, resilience strategies, and success stories of overcoming the obstacles. In this family, no one is alone. Welcome to Respond to Resilience with co-hosts retired Lieutenant David Dashinger, Dr. Stacy Raymond, and Bonnie Rumely, LCSW, EMTB.
And we're going to be speaking to Jason Palomara and Michelle Giorgiani today. I'm going to give you a little bit of background on our guests. Michelle is a first responder liaison at Aware Recovery Care. She's 33 years sober and a former juvenile probation counselor and has been a part-time dispatcher at a police department in Fairfield County. She's worked in recovery for over 25 years. Jason Palomara is a U.S. Navy veteran and a retired New York City Police Department cold case homicide detective with 20 years of experience in forensic and criminal investigations. Jason has served as a peer support counselor with the NYPD, and he's the director of veteran and first responder engagement for Forge VFR. Jason's currently writing a book on police wellness and resilience with Barbara Rubel. Jason, Michelle, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Yeah.
So Bonnie, why don't you kick off the questioning today?
Michelle, we're really happy to have you here. Aware has been a wonderful force, I think, in Connecticut and other states, and really doing some cutting-edge work with first responders. So along that line, I wanted to ask you, why should substance abuse treatment be different for first responders than the general population?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me. Second of all, this is a subject that's like, it really passionate from my heart because my whole family is first responders as well. But it, you know, they have different needs. They have unique needs from a general population. You know, there are different things that we don't think about. Like the major one is they're all helpers. Who's helping the helpers? Right. So as far as stress, they have extra trauma that a normal person doesn't see on a daily basis. Right. And they see things on, some people will call it a regular day in the job. Well, it's really not a regular day in the job. The trauma that they see and hear and deal with on a daily basis is something that normal people don't have the wherewithal and the skill set to deal with. So that's one reason. Another reason would be the culture. There is a completely different culture in, you know, firefighting and law enforcement and, you know, any kind, even nurses, EMTs, any kind of first responder. You know, I have to say it's more like a brotherhood and, you know, a very close-knit family, I would say, right? Because I'm in substance abuse care looks a little bit different in the tools that we use with them rather than general population.
Well, Jason, you have an impressive resume with your military background in the Navy and your NYPD career. So what is your role at Forge and how do you explain how Forge supports veterans and first responders?
Thank you for having me as well. So I'm the Director of Veteran and First Responder Engagement. So anything having to do with veterans and first responders falls under my purview. Forge, we're a behavioral healthcare company providing intensive outpatient treatment for veterans, first responders, and their families. That's an important piece to not leave out. I see Michelle nodding and she knows, you can't leave out the family portion of it. I learned that the hard way. May or may not get into that later, but we do this through a technology-enabled treatment model. So in-person telehealth, and we strive to get a person into care within 24 hours. And when we talk about first responders, speed to care is so vital. Hopefully we'll get into that as well. If they want that. So normally it's more often than not, it's less than 24 hours. I try to contact, the person, looking for care immediately. Cause that window is so, so very small. So, it's important for everyone to get connected to care, but with first responders for very specific reasons, it's vital.
If somebody's made that call or you've found out that they're looking to receive care, how do you build trust with them? Obviously, it must be a vulnerable moment for them, and they're needing to speak to somebody who can really address their particular needs. What do you do that's different than someone who's not familiar with responders and veterans?
That's a great question. And I'll tell you, honestly, I have an unfair advantage because I can't tell you how often they ask, "Are you a first responder? Are you a cop?" And it's usually at the beginning few sentences of the conversation. So once they realize that they're talking to one of their own, and somebody mentioned family, and I think in the intro mentioned family quite a few times, it is 100% true. When they realize they're talking to somebody that gets them, it really immediately breaks down barriers that others would have to hurdle.
Michelle, you had mentioned before that some of the techniques you would use with first responders are different. So, given the culture, given the family aspect, and given what Jason just said, that we know when we get a call from a first responder, it's their 911, right? Whether it's substance abuse, suicidal ideation. So what are some of the techniques that you use that are different to that population?
The first one is, in a first responder's comfort zone, they're very big on confidentiality, right? So that is a main thing that it is very, very important, whether it's their job or their feelings that they can't promote or letting the general public know that they have some of the same problems that we have. It is you got to handle it with kid gloves, right? They can't really feel comfortable in support groups that the general population would feel comfortable in. A real quick example, a cop that arrested somebody yesterday for DUI walks in and sees a person he just arrested in a meeting. That's not going to make him feel very comfortable, to get his needs met. Not that there's any separation, but it's like, where do we draw the line between knowing full disclosure and keeping some things, they're held to a different standard. I mean, than the general public. So we have to treat them that way. That's one thing, is the confidentiality. The next thing would be, because they have a deep trauma level, it's very important that we don't re-traumatize the first responders. They've had enough trauma that they see on a daily basis, and making them dig too deep if they're not ready to, put everything on the table, active listening is going to be a huge part of it, because sometimes they just need somebody to vent to, right? To make sure, like Jason said before, to make sure that building of that trust, that we get it. We understand the culture. We understand that maybe, you might not want to, put everything out in public. So that trust, that confidentiality, that trauma base, all of that is so key to making them feel comfortable so they are able to be treated and want to be treated, right? And the active listening is huge.
Thank you.
So Jason, on that topic, when somebody has reached you as the point of first contact and you're building that trust, and they're starting to understand that you're one of them, as a veteran and a former police officer, what questions do you ask them when they're contacting you?
Well, I'll tell you, one of the questions they ask, or one of the things they mention immediately is that, you know, I don't know what the first step is. And I love when that is presented, because it's an opportunity to highlight for them, you've just made it. You've just made the first step. If you hadn't, we wouldn't be on this phone call, you know. And them taking a step back, and sometimes there's a bit of silence, and it's, oh, I guess I did, you know. So that's important, you know, just being more interested than interesting, right? And listening. Like Michelle talked about active listening, and it really holds true, because they listen all day long to victims, to witnesses, what have you. And now they want to be listened to. And it's tough for them to switch roles. So like Michelle said, just really being that ear, allowing them a safe place to kind of unpack what's been bothering them, goes a really, really long way.
And once they've achieved that first step that you're mentioning, what are the next steps if they want to get help?
So depending on the area in which they're calling, you know, in what state, and what they're looking for, you know, I've had some that are completely against telehealth, and one in person, and vice versa. So identifying what is comfortable for them, you know, what their needs are. Is it just mental health? Is there a substance component to it? And then connecting them with our team, right? Some want male, some want female. Just determining their specific needs so we can get them connected and make them feel comfortable throughout the process. And when I say throughout the process, I stick with them. I tell them, you have me now. That could be a good thing, a bad thing, but I stick with them. Because, you know, as a first responder, and I'll tell you from personal experience, we're used to making the decisions. So when we get to the point where we drop back and we're like, okay, I need help, we don't want to have to figure it out. I don't want to have to call five times for an appointment. I don't want to have to leave messages, wonder what the next step is. I want you to figure it out for me. So I stick with them. And I'll tell you, full transparency, I did not know the full scope of my insurance coverage, the behavioral health component of my insurance for 20 years. I really didn't find out the intricacies of it until I retired. So think about how many cops don't know really what's available to them. So I help to try to educate them what they have available to them, how it works, you know, and take that decision-making away so they can concentrate on themselves.
Great point.
Fairfield County Trauma Response Team is a nonprofit alliance of mental health professionals dedicated to helping first responders heal from trauma, tragedy, and stress. We help as they manage community crises and the everyday demands of ensuring public health and safety. Established in 2011, FCTRT was formed in response to a call for emotional help from the Stamford Fire Department after a traumatic fatal fire. Less than a year later, the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting occurred, and members again served the first responder community. Most recently, COVID-19 created a need for our support. We provide free educational presentations, pro bono sessions to deal with community disasters, and an extensive referral service to trauma-informed psychotherapists. If you're a responder in Fairfield County and need help dealing with duty-related stress, please reach out to us so you can continue to do the job you love. Visit our website at fctrt.org or find us on Instagram at Fairfield County TRT.
So we've talked to both of you a bit about what are some of the do's and the important things that have to take place to engage a first responder, right? But what are some of the don'ts? And I would open this to both of you, but Michelle, if you want to start, what are some of the don'ts that first responders can also look for in getting substance abuse treatment?
Well, the first thing, we talked about establishing the trust, right? And they are used to being looked at, some of them that don't know either police work or fire work, the common person is in awe of them. Oh, tell me about that. Tell me, you know, what you did, this, that. They really see that all day long. They kind of just want to be on equal ground to know that you get it and humanize them. I want to break it down like I break it down to everyone else because, you know, they're people too, right? So that's one thing, that just humanizing them is real important. I know that Jason said they want you to figure it out, but at the same time, simultaneously, they want to know that they're the one making the decisions and they're not forced into anything, right? So that's really important too, because how often do we, you know, say, you need to do this, you need to do that. No, they need to feel comfortable saying, I need this, I want to do this, and that putting them on that road to making all their options available, what feels comfortable to them, right? And what's going to work for them.
Jumping to a different angle, we talk about this a lot. Bonnie and I were just talking about this offline, and that's responders and military transitioning into the next chapter of their life when they retire. So, Jason, I'm curious about your story. How did you find your way into doing this line of work after retiring, and what was your motivation?
Well, that's a loaded question. So towards the end of my career, I was fortunate enough to become a peer support member under Jeff Thompson's peer support program with the NYPD. Like I'm sure every first responder listening to the show and that's out there, they've had their own trials and tribulations and road, you know, speed bumps and roadblocks to navigate around. I did as well. I got to the point where, you know, I realized that if I was Googling how many drinks it was before it was considered unhealthy, that was a problem. But as Googling that was a problem, it was also amazing. I didn't know it was amazing at that time, but you know, in retrospect, it's at that point I decided that what I was doing was not serving me and I needed to make a pivot change. You know, that period could be lost on some, but for me, I said, I have to do something. I wanted to fix so many different things, and I realized nothing could be fixed unless I fixed the person that was staring back at me in the mirror. So that was the catalyst for me, you know, and then I was told that you'll know when it's time to retire, and I never understood what that meant. I retired during the pandemic and the defund the police, and I started to identify more with helping in a different way than what I was doing. I was in cold case, and it was the best time on the job. But I felt it. I felt that it was time to retire. And then transitioning, nobody prepared me for what that really was. And officers too often forget that they enter this profession before they're done developing. And they develop around guys and girls that know how to handle things, right? Or believe they do, whether it be mental health, whether it be financial. And that's what we grow up around. And then we retire, and back to the mirror analogy, we look in the mirror and we expect to know who that is, you know? And when we don't, that's scary. We have to get to know each other all over again. And it really hit home when the officers were murdered in Harlem about a month ago. I felt that not on the battlefield feeling. Nobody prepared me for that either. That's kind of really what got me into this space, and just trying to provide that curiosity for tomorrow, right? Somebody who's all but said, I'm done. And to give them that little bit of curiosity, all right, maybe I'll see what tomorrow looks like. That's a win. That's a win. Even if it's for just the next day, that's a win.
Hey, Michelle, why do you do what you do with AWARE?
Well, for a lot of reasons. From my family, I still have two active lieutenants in Norwalk, Connecticut that are family. I have, my dad was a sergeant in Wilton, Connecticut. My family, and I see the struggles. I saw the struggles on a daily basis, you know, whether it was just being available all the time and lack of sleep and lack of, you know, self-care. Self-care is huge. And they struggle, first responders struggle with it because they put, again, their helpers, they put everybody else first, right? So that's a major thing. You know, the way they deal with stress is different. You know, we have, of course, first responders that can deal with it in a healthy way. And we have first responders that don't necessarily know healthy ways to deal with stress, which can lead to the end I'm on, which is substance abuse and that type of thing. So, and, you know, often it affects their careers, you know, in various ways, whether it's not being fit for duty, whether it's not promoting, whether it's not being a responsible backup partner, you know, whatever that looks like, those are big struggles that I feel like if there's some coping mechanisms, skills, techniques that they can incorporate. You don't know this if you don't know it, right? You have to be taught. So that's where my passion comes from. And especially in today's society and culture where first responders, you know, some of them are the enemy instead of the helper today. And I feel like it's very important because moving forward in the future, we're not going to have good, solid, you know, public service people the way things are going at this point. So as much as the word as help, everything we can get out there to support these people will help everyone.
Thank you.
Sure. Jason, let's talk about these challenges in responders and law enforcement officers seeking help. And what are some of the roadblocks you find, and what are other cultural problems within emergency services that make it difficult for them to actually get the help?
Well, there's many, to name a few. And I think, Michelle, you might agree, it's perception amongst their peers, right? We spend our day around people that need our help. And when we are that person, it's difficult to accept that we might need that help. Challenges and you know, you talk about the stigma and challenges that kind of intersect. An officer might reach out for help, and I'll touch on that small window. Today, tomorrow, nah, I'm good. I figured it out, right? It's that quick. Or overtime comes up. I'd rather take that overtime than, you know, maybe make that appointment, because if I don't make that overtime, I can't pay my bills, right? Or the perception of being labeled somebody that, you know, I'm sure every department has their own terminology, but, you know, being labeled as somebody that may be broken, right? Mm-hmm. Or a problem. And then the fear of maybe losing your firearm, right, wrong, or indifferent, officers identify as that as part of who they are. So the fear of losing that piece of their identity is another barrier, just to name a few.
That's an interesting point too, because I think we can all recognize that first responders, it's not just a job, it becomes your identity, right? Whether you're paid or volunteer. And that's why I think what both of you are doing is so important, because you're recognizing that this is a totally different culture. You are both first responders in your own ways. And I think that's what helps you connect with them. You understand the background. You understand what it means to do those jobs. And I think that's probably along the lines, Michelle, of why it's easier for you to do some of the work that you do with your first responders, because you can relate. Absolutely. And I know I feel that way too, in my private practice. You know, the minute they know I'm in EMS, that cuts a lot of the explaining they have to do to me about a scene and acronyms. And, you know, I just think it makes it so much easier for them to access all of us, right? When they know that they don't have to go down those roads of explaining.
Bonnie, you mentioned identity. Just real quick, I've said it to many, and I had to say it to myself often, that we're human beings that happen to be cops and not the other way around. Mm-hmm. And we forget that often through our careers. And then when we take off that armor, that uniform, that gun belt, what are we left with?
Right. And David and I have talked about this on another podcast as well, but it's something I think that happens by accident sometimes, right? Some people get very obsessed with the career, or it becomes their whole identity. They don't care. They don't hold on to other hobbies or things outside of it. And then all of a sudden, one day they retire and now they don't have anything outside of that. And that's something we've had some conversations about. So I think it's important to take pride in one's work, but important to keep other things going on outside of it as well, and friendships that aren't totally reliant on it.
Absolutely. And that's a major reason for addiction and substance abuse, because at, you know, when they're left with really who am I and all this free time on their hands, you know, and they don't have good coping skills, it's easy to pick up a negative coping skill and get lost in that. And, you know, you want to have a wonderful, you worked hard your whole life. You want to have a wonderful retirement. And sometimes coupled with the PTSD and everything else in unfortunately the substance abuse line, you know, that really clouds everything and darkens retirement when, again, you've worked so hard your whole life, you know, working different shifts, long hours, seeing things that no human being should see, right? It's your time to shine in retirement, not, you know, not go dark.
Our mission at Responder Wellness, Inc. is to subsidize or provide free of charge safety equipment and wellness services to first responders, including police officers, firefighters, EMS personnel, and 911 operators throughout Connecticut. Resources include scholarships to train new EMTs, a responder and veteran-only AA group in Danbury, Connecticut, as well as police vests, a fire and EMS boot program, yoga classes, gym memberships, and t-shirts. The founder of Responder Wellness, Inc. co-leads a peer support group sponsored by Fairfield County Trauma Response Team. Responder Wellness, Inc. is a nonprofit 501c3. Find us on the web at responderwellness.org, on Facebook at Responder Wellness, Inc., or email us responderwellness@gmail.com. Responder Wellness, Inc., putting responders first.
Let's talk a little bit about how you both deliver services, or at least how your organization delivers services. We'll start with you, Michelle. Talk a little bit about the admissions process and then what services are offered and how they are delivered, please.
Well, in the admissions process, you know, a lot of it for first responders is word of mouth, right? Because we know the, again, to bring up that confidentiality factor. So when somebody reaches out to us, we identify them as a first responder and realize that they have these unique needs. So we do have other first responders in Aware Recovery Care that are certified recovery advisors, you know, people, again, that have been there and know that. So we purposefully try to pair them up with those employees that specialize in that. That's the first thing. The second thing, you know, throughout the, you know, we cater to those different needs. There's different interventions that we would give or work with a first responder than we'd give someone else. You know, there's different stages of when a client comes to us. One might be that, you know, his department told him he needed to get treatment before he returns to duty. And that what that looks like for us is we want to get them to be the best they can be to return to duty at 100%. And if they're in retirement, a lot of retirement for the reasons we just talked about, a lot of retired firefighters, nurses, police reach out to us because they don't know how to cope without having that, you know, huge career slash identity. So, you know, we offer something I think that's unique with word of mouth, again, with shows like that you guys are bringing on, is spreading the word a little more. But it was very secretive and a taboo kind of thing for a helper to get help, right? So we want to make it, take away that stigma and make it totally okay, you know, to make it better and stronger, and it will come out in everybody's personal life as well as their work.
Great. And Jason, can you speak to how Forge delivers care? You mentioned telehealth, and is it all done virtually, or are there other ways that you do the treatment?
Both, a hybrid model, so in person and via telehealth, specific to what the client might prefer. They can go onto our website and self-refer. Somebody could, you know, a clinician could refer a client. They can contact us directly. We have an intake line. I could provide that at some point during the show. They can email me direct. Many different ways. You know, we're leaving you. My colleague Dalton McLaughlin, he likens it to the highway to help. Right? As first responders, we're going to find our own exits. I'm not going to provide any for you, right? And I'm going to block off the ones as they're coming. So many different ways you can reach us. And I don't know if I mentioned again, info@forgehealth.com. You could send an email, which is our main line, and it'll get to me. As far as the clinicians, if they're not veterans or first responders themselves, they're culturally competent. Besides the general Forge training that one would go through, they have to go through us veterans and first responders before they're given our stamp. Because I think somebody mentioned, an officer does not want to have to explain acronyms to them, explain what getting ordered in on a day off means, getting stuck on a detail. They don't want to know what that is. They don't want to have to explain that for 20 years they've had to have their spouse go to parties and events without them, canceled at the last minute. They need to understand what that means and how that affects them having reached out for help.
And I think Jason just brought up another good point, is availability at AWARE. You know, first responders aren't 9-to-5ers. So availability is very important, as far as we have an emergency hotline for first responders, because it may be 2 in the morning. It may be, but we need to be available because that's their time, you know. So that's very important, too, the flexibility and the availability of working around their shift schedules.
Well, we'd love to put that phone number up too, Michelle, for our viewers. And the other thing, I believe AWARE also offers in-home. Is that right?
Absolutely. And it is hybrid because of COVID, but we are based, and we'd much rather do in-home, because we treat the home as a treatment center, and that's where people are most comfortable. And that means, again, more confidentiality. We come to them. They're not, you know, they have enough stress on their plate. We don't need to add stress. We need to relieve some of that from them.
Mm-hmm. I think that's great. I think that idea of you going to them makes it easier. And then it also feeds that confidentiality. Like you said, they don't have to worry about walking into a building and being seen. There's a cartoon that one of my colleagues has, and it's a police car next to a therapist's office. And he's going in the back door, like, let me get in there and get out before anyone sees me. And for anybody that works with the culture, they understand that's huge. So I think the fact that you do the in-home piece is so important.
And as well, that Jason brought up again, families, that's a huge piece. And at the home, you're interacting with the family as well. I mean, they have the same, maybe a couple different issues, like he said, showing up to events alone and that type of thing. But there's also, they see their struggles on a daily basis, and sometimes they're a soft place to fall for the first responder, and they also need a soft place to fall. So we provide that for families as well.
Bonnie, I had a detective, NYPD detective, last week say, oh no, the T word, therapist. He said, I don't like the T word. So, yeah.
You know what I'm talking about.
Thank you.
Somebody mentioned this earlier. Let's take it a little further. In terms of insurance costs and other options, Jason, can you speak to treatment for substance abuse and what financial options are there?
So financial options, and I'll coincide with our states that I didn't mention, so I don't miss any. I'm going to look. We're New Hampshire, Massachusetts, New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Virginia, and Connecticut. And depending on the state, different programs and capabilities. We're in network with most major insurance companies. If we're not, we'll work to get network with them. At times, we'll do single case agreements. We're the payer of last resort, so we'll figure out a way with you. There'll never be a financial barrier to care for you, because it's so specific to first responders too, right? Do I say something and now not have to not be able to work my off-duty job? Which, listen, as cops, we build that into our budgets. That's part of our budget. Right, wrong, or indifferent, we it's built in. So if we can't work our off-duty job, or we're not permitted now to make overtime because what we're called limited or restricted, right? We'd rather not have that financial burden. So now if we get to the point where we're with a first responder, we don't want to present another financial burden for them. So we'll figure it out with them.
How about, Michelle, how does AWARE approach these different payment options?
That's the same thing. Look, we take Anthem, we take a couple major insurances, but if we don't happen to take that insurance, you know what? We'll figure out an alternative, because we believe it is so important, you know, the work that we're doing. Another thing is these are offered. A lot of, you know, first responders are not going to reach out to their EAP or their groups because, again, for reasons they may not want their peers involved in anything treatment oriented or anything like that. So, you know, we will figure out a way to get them the best treatment that we can.
I think that's great. And I think it's music to everyone's ears listening, because the cost and the insurance, that piece causes so much anxiety for people. And I know sometimes that really is the barrier, even to them coming to myself. You know, that's the first question they have once they get the courage to say, I need the help. The second question after that is about how is this going to work? Because they work so hard to have their livelihood and to plan for the future. And like you said, the extra jobs, the overtime, the missing holidays with family, it's not because they want to, it's because they have to.
Exactly.
To make it work. So I think both of you, what your programs are doing is helping to alleviate and taking that layer away.
Thank you. And that goes again. We want to relieve some of the stress that they already have in multitude of areas.
Let's go a little bit into what happens now. Somebody's kind of worked through the entry level admission process. The financial stuff has been worked out. So what does a typical day look like for them in your treatment process? Michelle, what would that look like?
Well, our program is a year-long program. It's 52 weeks. And in the beginning, you work with your team, which is a care coordinator, a nurse, and two certified recovery advisors. And they surround the client. And in the beginning of the program, we go really hard. And we try to meet with the client, you know, at least four times a week. And that is as we build a rapport and the trust starts moving and, you know, the client feels comfortable, then we drop down in visits. And it's not just like substance abuse, quote, treatment like an IOP. It's life skills, too. You know, we can go. It's not just sitting in a room. We can go hiking with them. We can do other things that I talked about, the self-care part of it. That's really, you know, that maybe they've never done that. They're like, I like this. And it, what a win-win. I'm relieving stress. I'm getting exercise. And, you know, I'm learning about myself. And that's an opportunity we get to teaching moments, right? And then at the end of the year, the goal is to be, you know, it's full strength, whether that means abstinence, whether that means being back on duty, whether that means being, you know, back with their families, whatever that looks like to or retirement, to incorporate a healthy lifestyle into their future.
Thank you. And Jason, can you speak to how Forge, what a typical day looks like? What is sort of the arc of a treatment over time?
So again, every state has its own programs, right? I'll highlight Pennsylvania, for example, right? So Pennsylvania, we offer, it's like a 12-week program, focuses on psychological, emotional, addiction issues, IOP, right? Integrated with co-occurring trauma therapy. Attendance is 3 days per week, 3 hours per day, though clients may attend up to 5 days a week. Most areas, you know, CBT, CPT, prolonged exposure therapy, motivational interviewing, so on and so forth. So, we see where there's a specific need or an increase in a need in a certain area, and we'll build out to accommodate. There is no one size fits all. Right. No one client that's going to be the same as the next. It's not a cookie cutter approach. Right. We continue to adapt to the client's needs. And I think that is really what's most important. Again, because no one is like the last.
I have another question. You both touched on the family aspect and how that's so important. And we do know that with first responders, we have to work with their family, their spouses. Do your programs offer some spousal or marriage counseling as well as part of treatment? Because this culture is particularly problematic, and we've looked at this on other podcasts, but particularly problematic for significant others. So I'm wondering what your programs do to address that.
Well, AWARE with the, when they get admitted to AWARE, they have 4 sessions of alcohol or substance abuse education for the family. There are 4 sessions that come in the package, and they aren't about the so-called client. They're about teaching the families how to deal with addiction in general. Right. So it's not really about, you know, the relationships and everything else. We want to make sure they're educated in the field so they know how to, you know, enhance the recovery of the client. And then after those 4 initial education sessions, we offer 4 sessions of family systems therapy, which is the part where Bonnie was talking about. It could be marriage counseling. It could be, you know, the whole family, the kids and the wife and, you know, the whole family together. It could be 2 sessions with the husband and wife, and then 2 sessions with the whole family. So we really try to make sure that everybody is treated, because addiction is a family disease, and it involves everybody in the family.
Thank you, Michelle. Jason, wondering what your thoughts are.
Yeah, Michelle, I made some notes of what you just said because it's so important. All the above: marriage, family, individual, couples therapy. Because I didn't realize early on, but I later on realized I was a really good isolator. Like we are professional isolators as cops, and we don't realize we're doing it, right? I'm not going to talk to my wife or my husband about, you know, the dead infant I just had to deal with on the job, right? And I think I'm protecting her from that. And she's saying in her mind, he's not talking to me, right? So now we have 2 things happening there. One of the things, I think, I don't know, Dave, you might touch on this later, but there's a good aspect of the job and a bad aspect. And it happens at the same time where we protect our own, right? We circle the wagons. Dave, I'm sure you've heard this. You know, if you ever need to talk, don't worry. I always have a cold one waiting for you, right? But if you look a little deeper into that part of that culture where that's how we, you know, cope, you know, choir therapy, liquid lunches, whatever you want to call it, we don't see that as a problem. Right? It's part normal part of the culture. So when it now interjects itself into the home life, it includes everybody. And Michelle, I think you said it's a family problem. And it's so true. So you can't separate that from the continuum of care. So we offer, you know, all that.
Well, you've both been sharing a lot of great information. And as we wrap up, is there anything that we didn't cover you'd like to mention, Michelle?
No, again, thank you for having us. It's an honor to be here. And the more we can get this kind of help and treatment and let everybody know it's available, the stronger we become as a society, you know? So thank you very much.
Thank you. Jason, any thoughts?
Just thank you. Everyone talks about, you know, destigmatizing asking for help, right? Destigmatize. You hear it so often. And how do you do it? This is exactly how you do it. By sharing, by talking about it. Any first responder listening to this, if there's one thing I can say, it's when you're uncomfortable, get excited at that point, because that's what's really going to reveal who you are, if you allow it to. Stretch yourself. You know, when you get uncomfortable, that's when you're going to get comfortable. So doing podcasts like this and you guys, you know, spreading the word, it's great. So thank you.
It's our pleasure.
We want to thank you both. It was wonderful meeting with you and talking to you today.
We're going to also just one last time put on the screen where people can get in touch with you. Jason, just talk about Forge's website for us, please.
Absolutely. ForgeHealth.com, right there. As far as doing a self-referral or referral for somebody else, they can go to forgehealth.com/contact-us. They can email info@forgehealth.com. They could call 888-244-7312. And you can always email me and I will get back to you. So not giving you any option to take that exit.
Great. And Michelle, how can people get in touch with Aware?
AwareRecoveryCare.com. And if potential clients can call admissions, and they'll be absolutely directed in the right way and identified and, you know, be linked with help. Again, we have for our first responder clients, we have a first responder hotline.
I'll just mention also that we have your social media handles here for Aware on Facebook and also for Forge on Facebook. I want to just thank both of you again for being here, sharing what you're doing in the world of substance abuse treatment for first responders and veterans. It is super important work, and you're helping also to smash the stigma by making this information available and by having innovative modern technology that really seems to help to make this possible in today's day and age. So thank you both for being guests with us today on Responder Resilience, and much success moving forward.
Thank you.
Just want to remind everybody to like and subscribe. Our YouTube channel is Responder Resilience. We are on Facebook, Responder Wellness Inc., also bbsradio.com and Apple Podcasts, and our website with all our previous episodes is respondertv.com. I want to wish everybody a safe evening. Stay safe. Be kind to yourself. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.